And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast on a beautiful Thursday afternoon in New York City, where I'm thrilled, as always, to be joined by one of my favorite guests from 538 and wearing a Michigan hoodie, Chris Herring. How are you?
Good, man. How are you?
I'm hanging in. We're like, every team has played between like 7 and 9 games. We're rolling now.
We're getting a sense of who to pay more attention to, it feels like.
We're 10 games, we're 10% or something into the NBA season, just like that.
I want to know, so me and my colleague Neil Payne, we're probably going to take a look at something pretty soon to figure out, I think it's been done already, like how much of the season can go by before you essentially can take a snapshot of the standings and more or less those are the teams that are going to make the playoffs, whether in that order or not. You know, I know the Rockets obviously last year, you know, kind of had a late season charge, but... Man, wouldn't it be fun if you're a Suns fan to just kind of, you know, pause everything where it is now?
We're going to talk about the Suns. We're going to talk about 4 interesting teams in the Western Conference that are not located in Los Angeles, California. That's the theme of this podcast. First, I do want to talk about managing of the loads because Kawhi Leonard sat out last night against Milwaukee and the pearls were clutched and the screaming was screamed and the fans were lamenting it and all of this. Do you have any thoughts on this, Mr. Herring?
I just think if, first of all, I'm not going to say it's random because, like you said, there was a national TV game on last night that I think a lot of people would have wanted to watch. I just find it really strange that we're having this conversation in a year where, not even a year after Kawhi just won a championship, and everyone in that organization seems to be crediting the fact that they handled him the way they did. Which I think they needed to, as someone he was going to be a free agent. And I imagine the same conversation was had with the Clippers, that he needed to be able to say if and when he was going to play, and when he's feeling good, when he's not. But I just kind of feel like at this point, haven't we lost the idea to be able to say he should or shouldn't be playing based on what he just did? If that matters most, we've let the Spurs do that forever. And maybe lit is a strong word, because I know the league came down on them about it at one point too. But... game ultimately doesn't matter. I get from a TV standpoint, it does. I get if you're a fan that's paid money. Me and a buddy went to go see the Lakers and Bucks last year. LeBron and Giannis sat out. It sucked. It sucks as a fan, but their job is not necessarily to be mindful of individual fans who buy tickets. It's to win a championship. And so if doing that, sitting out when he needs to or when he feels like he's not ready to go or when he wants a break is his best chance to do that, he probably has a better sense of that than we do. And I think I'm I've said this to you before on your podcast, I'm never going to make an argument that a player should be playing when they feel like they shouldn't be. If it's a management day, so be it. But the season's too long. And until we shorten it, I said we as if you and me have a say in that. Until the season is shortened, I don't really think we get a say in when and if they sit out.
Ryan Russillo had an interesting thread about this yesterday on Twitter. And he pointed out that the science is uncertain, and that's true. Teams who have invested enormous amounts of money and time in trying to figure out injury prevention, fatigue, all of this, you know, they haven't quite thrown their hands up in the air because they've learned lots of stuff, but they don't know 100% for sure that that load management is as necessary as some teams make it out to be. They don't know. The science is totally uncertain. Some of these big fancy companies come up, teams buy their products and realize it's snake oil 2 years later and don't have it. But I certainly think the science has crawled in the direction of caution. And this is what is a little weird about the load management outcry is that like 2 months ago, Baxter Holmes comes out with this big 2-part series about not only load management in the NBA, but how AAU players are exhibiting, according to like actual experts who do this for a living, are exhibiting signs of wear and tear in their knees by like age 12. And when that story comes out, there's Baxter on Outside the Lines. There's every NBA commentary being like, this is really important work. Read this work. And then when David Fizdale says load management is bunk. RJ Barrett's 19. We're going to play him 40 minutes a game if we want. Everyone laughs at David Fizdale. And then a team sits Kawhi Leonard out on a national TV back to back. Newsflash to the NBA. You put Kawhi Leonard's team on a national TV back-to-back. This is what is going to happen.
That's part
so
to
we all laud these pieces about this is really important work. Like, we're really digging in with – they're loaded with scientists being like, red flag, red flag, red flag, red flag. Players are deteriorating faster, jumper's knee, blah, blah, blah. And then a team actually does it in a circumstance of a back-to-back with a player who has a history of leg problems – and people are mad about it. Like, I don't understand how you can be – there's definitely an overlap in the Venn diagram of people who are tweeting the Baxter Holmes and stories of that ilk and making fun of Fizdale and being mad about Kawhi Leonard's load management. I just don't understand how that can be.
Me personally, also, if anyone watched the game last night, it was an entertaining game anyway. Not to say that it wouldn't be more entertaining if Kawhi played, but if that's the concern – I get it when you've got a totally garbage game on. The game was fine last night. It was really entertaining. Anyway.
The game the Spurs were fine for all those years ago was in a, they almost beat the Heat with Matt Bonner and whoever else was playing in that game.
Yeah, so I don't know. Like I said, and you're absolutely right that on the one hand you have people that are worried about the health of these players, but then you hear things that run counter to that. And I just having lived in Chicago, living in Chicago now, I just, after the Derrick Rose stuff, I'm of the opinion that when players sit out, whether it's because of a very clear fear that they're going to get hurt again, or the idea that you're trying to make sure that they don't get hurt again, you've lost the right. And when I say you, I guess I'm referring to the people that were angry and shouting about Rose and then just go dead silent when he has multiple knee injuries after that. Kawhi had an injury, and it's like, even if you questioned whether he actually had one, in San Antonio, or that he didn't feel comfortable with his body, whatever he did, sitting out that time and playing last year in Toronto and managing his condition the way he did, it paid off. And his job is for it to pay off each time. So I'm not gonna argue the logic behind that, particularly in an early season game. I'm just not.
It's Kawhi was dragging ass by the end of last year's finals.
He was.
Appeared to suffer a leg injury in the Milwaukee series and was limping around the corridors in parts of that series. Was like, watch the fourth quarter of the clinching game. Kawhi didn't do anything in that quarter other than dive for a couple loose balls. Probably took a few shots. I don't remember. That was the Fred VanVleet show. Like, Kawhi was dragging ass. Now, is that evidence that he needs to be load managed? Is it evidence that he had a random injury at a random time that had nothing to do with being load managed or not? I don't know.
We'll probably never know.
But I can't blame the Clippers for monitoring
because
for managing the old load. Managing, you got to manage the load.
Because there's a national TV game. And that's the part where I get it. And I heard what Doris said, and Doris is one of my favorite people. So it's not to disagree with her necessarily, but it's not his job to be worried about that. And, you know,
it's not his job to be worried about that, particularly as Jalen Rose so saliently put it yesterday on the J&J show. The discourse about NBA players has gotten so poisonous about it's rings or you're a scrub. And how many rings does he have? Rings, rings, rings. Well, if Kawhi Leonard thinks the only way for me to get another ring is to be load managed and all these people seem to care about who are debating my legacy is rings, 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 well, I'm going to do whatever it takes to be healthy in April and May. The Sixers are going to do this with Joel Embiid. The NBA, without saying it, has come out and said, without coming out and saying it directly, has essentially said 82 games is too many. They're doing everything they can to the schedule to eliminate back-to-backs, introduce rest, lengthen the All-Star game. Kevin Arnovitz reported in July for the 75th anniversary season, they're contemplating a lot of things, including, as he wrote, also a reduction in the 82-game regular season schedule. That's real. That's a true thing. They're still contemplating that. So the NBA has already sent us the message. They have too many games. What they're really concerned about is the TV money. That's it.
Of course.
National TV money. And yes, that trickles down to player salaries through BRI and all that. Don't put Kawhi Leonard's team on a national TV back-to-back. How many times were the Clippers on national TV this year? If you count NBA TV, it's like 30 games.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Like, this is going to happen. Live with it. That's my end of the load. I don't want to manage any more loads. Do you have any more loads to manage?
I don't.
Any load to get off your chest?
I don't. I think we're both in lockstep with that. I just don't. I mean, and I hadn't even really thought about that part of it, but particularly his teams, after what we saw last year, and something that worked for him last year, that worked for his team last year, it's probably best not to have them on TV when they've got two games in a row.
Do you ever feel like ticketing websites make getting to the event difficult on purpose? It's like they're so big they can get away with not caring about the customer experience, the only thing they should care about. With millions of live event tickets and a price match guarantee, that's important. SeatGeek proves there's a better way. You can search sports, live music, comedy, Broadway, more. SeatGeek has the tickets you're looking for all in one place. Your days of going to 15 sites on the secondary market are over. SeatGeek pulls millions of tickets from all over the web. It rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10 and displays them on an interactive seat map that is so easy to use. Green dots mean good deals. Red dots are maybe less good deals. Every purchase is fully guaranteed so you can shop for tickets with confidence. Confidence is important. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the fastest and easiest way to find tickets. They help me get tickets to Broadway shows like Hamilton, lots of different things. SeatGeek will even give you $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do is use our promo code. So download the SeatGeek app today. Use promo code LOWE, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. Bam, $10 off your first purchase. That's promo code LOWE for $10 off your first purchase with SeatGeek. Okay, let's put... Well, I'm not going to put 15 minutes on the clock because I don't want to hold my, I don't want to hold myself to any artificial constraint. Time is but an artificial constraint, Chris Herring. I want to talk about four teams that are not located in Los Angeles, California. Apologies to the Lakers who are absolutely balling.
Or in Oakland, California for that matter, or San Francisco.
Oh, they're watching their games is like, whoa, what in the hell? Jordan Poole took another shot. It's not going well.
Eric Pascal's fun to watch.
He is. Is it Pascal or Pascal?
That is part of the challenge of having a team that has people that you don't know who they are, is that you still have to figure out how to pronounce their name. So I'll have it figured out by the next time I come on the podcast.
Team number one that we're going to talk about is the single best story in the NBA so far this season. The 5-2 Phoenix Suns, 10th in offense and 5th in defense, and overall net rating, they are 3rd. Yep. I thought the Suns would be better this year. I still had them in my bottom tier of the 8 worst teams in the NBA. I certainly did not expect this. You, two questions, answer either one of them. What exactly is happening, and or is this a real thing? What are your expectations for the Suns the rest of the year? You wrote about the Suns on 538 last week. People should go read that, first of all.
I don't even feel like it was particularly all that informative, but I think there are a couple things happening. Is it real? Man, I hope it is. And I think there are parts of it that are. I think there are some potential pitfalls, though. One of the bigger questions that we're eventually going to have to ask is, man, like, what happens with Ayton when he comes back? Because obviously he's a part of your future. But a big part of what feels real about what they're doing is just their center rotation and the way they're playing Baines and the way they're playing Kaminsky, the way they're playing them together, which has been interesting because they're blowing teams out of the water when those two are playing at the same time. But I think the biggest thing, and you've alluded to this, I don't know if it's been when I've been on the podcast or if it's been with other people, you were basically saying, look, I'm still a believer in Booker. We don't know exactly what it'll be, but I'm more willing to bet on somebody that can do the things he can do at his age and to see him when he's got a real roster around him. He's got real NBA players around him now. Like, they may not be exactly who you'd want if you're starting a team necessarily, but Rubio, for better or worse, for, you know, all the frustration that certain people might have had about him in Minnesota, he's not going to be the reason your team loses. And, like, you know, obviously he's got his shortcomings on offense. He also has very useful, productive skills on offense. He can defend his position for the most part. There are games where he's going to struggle there. He can't shoot. We all know that. He can be a liability, a huge liability from that standpoint. But if you've got a team where you need to get people the ball and not allow for teams to just load up on one guy, he's a really, really good player to have. And I think we've seen that before in a couple different situations. And I think that's helped Booker tremendously. When you talk about Baines and the way he screens, that helps tremendously. When you talk about how rugged he is, that helps tremendously. One of the biggest shifts they've made this year, I think, their defensive rebounding. I think they went from dead last in the league to 10th so far. So that's a big shift for them. They cut a lot more than they did last year. So I think, you know, a lot of the stuff, I have so many friends in Chicago who are massive Bulls fans, and they're, like, furious that the Bulls didn't at least talk to other coaches.
I'm glad you bring up the Chicago Bulls because this has been a good two weeks for Devin Booker optimists. And Phoenix fans should know, they can look up everything I've ever written about Devin Booker. I am a Devin Booker optimist, have always been a Devin Booker optimist. There are two players I think the Andrew Wiggins experience has made some analytics people sort of overcautious on scorers who play for bad teams.
Sure.
In terms of, like, I've had analytics people, including guys who work for teams, not just writers or whatever, ask me in the last 6 months, A, are we sure Donovan Mitchell is good? Like, that's a question I've been asked.
Wow.
And B, are we sure, like, Devin Booker just isn't Zach LaVine? Which is why I said thank you for bringing up the Bulls. And, like, Zach LaVine's all right. But, like, the questions are stemming from this sort of Wiggins-y fear of just empty calories numbers. Sure. Are these guys just losers? And you would look at the numbers and you would look at the team records. You would think, oh, the Zach LaVine, Devin Booker, that's interesting. It's a question worth asking. Donovan Mitchell, yeah, his assist to turnover ratio was awful last year. He shot it terribly for the first half of the season. Is he just a gunner? Like, real people ask me these questions. Like, and then you just watch. Like, sometimes you just watch and you're like, oh, no, those guys are good.
Yeah.
Like, that guy's good. Devin Booker averaged 7 assists. He just threw a lefty whip pass to the right corner that Zach LaVine can't see. Like you just watch him and you're like, no, that, like, Devin Booker averaged 27-7 last year, and you knew if he didn't have to do everything for the Phoenix Suns, he's going to shoot threes better. Just look at his jump shot. He's a good shooter. He's just a good player. He was always a good player. This year, he's 50-50-90 right now and might make the All-Star team.
Yeah, and I think the big thing, too, with him, he's – and it's very clear this is – seems like it's come from Monty Williams. He's kind of addressed it a little bit where he's kind of asked Booker if he wants a certain guy, and Booker's like, of course I do. Feeling a little bit like the Kerr thing with Steph a little bit, where he's challenging him to defend certain guys. He's working his butt off on defense.
He's playing hard.
And that was, in particular, what you'd called out before, where that's been the argument. Normally, when we talk about empty calories, that's always the concern.
But like, even that was different than Zach LaVine. Because Zach LaVine will make mistakes on defense, and I asked him about this on my podcast. It's not a secret. He'll just be in the wrong place or not see, like, a thing happen and be so far behind the play, they'll be like, does he even know what's going on? Devin Booker's mistakes were like, yeah, that's a young guy on a bad team who, like, knows what's going on and is not trying.
Right. And so that this season, that was kind of the test, or that's been the test. I don't know that we came in knowing that that was going to be the test, but now he's got pros around him. He's got vets that have not only tried, but, you know, a lot of times are maybe the hardest effort guys on their team. You know, the fact that they've been winning, and not just winning, but when you look at the losses they've had, they've been very, very narrow losses. They could very easily...
Two very good teams, Utah and Denver, I believe,
they could very easily be undefeated right now. I mean, which feels crazy to say a couple weeks into the season, but that's also what you get when you talk about a team that is number three in net rating that you're in every game. So he's working harder, and I think that that sort of thing has a really top-down sort of impact on the rest of the club. Especially when you have other young guys on the team. The veterans are going to be out there playing hard regardless. But when you don't give maximum effort, particularly on defense, that stuff trickles down. And, you know, when you're playing harder and everybody sees it and you're still producing on the offensive side, that stuff trickles down as well. And so it's been noticeable. And the thing that if you had to give one reason not to give up on him before, which we also shouldn't be giving up on 21, 22, 23-year-olds anyway. But if you had to have one reason, you look at the guy's basketball reference page, pretty much every season, his point totals were going up and his assist totals were going up, which, like, you normally don't see both of those things happen at his efficiency, particularly when he's getting the defensive attention that he's always gotten. And so that alone, you know, you get the right coach, you get the right players around him, you get him in the right system. You don't want to give up on people that young, but I do think that's been a big part of it, is that I think he's bought in completely. He's got a guy that screens for him that makes life difficult for the people trying to defend him.
Aaron Baines is a – if you gave me, like, okay, here's a physical challenge. You have to run full speed into the chest of any human being in the NBA. Aaron Baines might be my last choice. I do not want to run full speed into that dude. It would be really – I don't know who my first choice would be, but it wouldn't be Aaron Baines. Aaron Baines will inflict pain.
He will inflict pain. He looks like he would inflict pain.
And you're right, by the way, when DeAndre – nobody – now, look, DeAndre Ayton in his first game of the season, and I believe his only game, looked really good.
4 blocks.
Defensively after – and I wrote several times last year, he started off the year – as bad and clueless defensively as any big man I have ever seen in the NBA. And by the middle and end of the year, he was just regular bad, which is fantastic progress for a rookie. He was bad, like, he started to figure out what was going on. Yeah, he's a little late here and there, but he's bad in a way that encouraged you that he could be average pretty soon. Maybe average is all he is, but given what he can do on offense,
you would
great.
Take that in a heartbeat.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And maybe better than average. But I do think Aaron Baines is a winning player. When you surround Aaron Baines with other high-usage guys, Devin Booker, Kelly Oubre very badly wants to be a high-usage guy and is scoring 20 a game.
Yeah.
Ricky Rubio has the ball a lot, not a high-usage guy, but a playmaker. He's a winner. Aaron Baines is a winner. Mm-hmm. DeAndre Ayton is a nominally, superficially better player than Aaron Baines. I'm not sure he's a better fit for that starting lineup in his second season, having coming off what will be a 25-game suspension.
And that's going to be the question, because the playing style, I mean, obviously, from a shooting standpoint, Baines with his range, the screening, but, man, like you said, from a usage standpoint, who do you really want getting those shots? If not, if these are different sorts of shots than the ones Booker's been able to get before, as far as the space he's getting because of how good the screens are, it's going to be interesting, because fundamentally it's a no-brainer who you need to be a key part of that rotation getting those minutes. But as far as, you know, it's going
to
be
they have to start Ayton.
There's no question about that. But it's going to be interesting, and I feel like you have this happen with a team or two every year, where you have a team that ends up being ahead of schedule as far as what people expected, and then you have to start making rotation decisions based on the idea of, like, well, we've got a real shot at the playoffs here, which if the Suns play well enough, then that's not a question, because then they're in and it's not problematic. But it does become interesting, because this is your number one pick from last year.
I'll bet you right now he'll never say it. He's never said it to me. Total speculation. Total speculation. Mm-hmm. I'll bet you right now Steve Clifford wishes Kem Birch could be his backup center, but it's Mo Bamba. Mo Bamba's playing all right,
yep.
But last year their season turned around when Kem Birch got those minutes.
Sure.
Kem Birch is good and knows how to play, and Mo Bamba's a rookie who's figuring out how to play. Now he's not anymore.
Yeah.
There's this sense, by the way, I've seen it, that Phoenix is getting lucky defensively, and I don't know if the numbers have changed in the last week. There's very little evidence that that's true. Only five teams have allowed fewer three-point attempts than the Suns have as a percentage of total shot attempts. And Phoenix has allowed 33% shooting on threes, which is the ninth lowest figure in the league, or the eighth lowest figure in the league. Mm-hmm. Low, but not like crazy low. And if you look at the advanced tracking numbers that we have that measure expected field goal percentage versus right. actual field goal percentage based on who's shooting, where they're shooting from, like, they're getting a tiny bit lucky. But, like, almost average.
They were almost average at what I looked at. I think they're like 15th or 16th.
There's no evidence that their defense is smoke and mirrors and just a lucky opponent shooting. There's no evidence of that.
They might be the only team. I didn't look for this particular statistic, but when I looked, and not adjusting it for luck or anything like that or for expected rates, top 10 in 3-point defense, top 10 in rim defense, top 10 in terms of what percentage of shots they're forcing from mid-range.
They force a hell of a lot of turnovers, which is good.
And
because
they're top three in that, yeah.
It's good. They better, because they foul the hell out of everyone. For like the 10th straight season, they are fouling the bejesus out of everybody.
They're fascinating, man, because it's honestly, there's a lot there that suggests that they could, that this is actually closer to what they are as opposed to just being a fluke. And, you know, I'd like to see it continue for another couple weeks, but it's going to be so hard to tell because Ayton is coming back at some point. And all of a sudden, it's going to change your rotation.
And I knew this would happen. I knew that when they started winning a little bit more, and it's not hard to win more than the Suns have won in the last 5 or 6
no,
years.
No, it is not.
that there would be a crowing from some members of their fan base that everyone, including me, who criticized their front office in the offseason was wrong, and look, they're winning more games. I wrote in my tears column, they will win more games this year, and it will not change the fact that they screwed up last summer. They screwed up last summer. They did, or I wrote, it does not change the fact that for the long term, they did not manage their resources in the optimal way. That's still true. Trading number 6 for Cam Johnson and Dario Saric, who, like, maybe is not going to be on the team next year and is not playing crunch time in a lot of games.
He's not playing pretty well.
That's a bad
well
trade. Yeah. The Josh Jackson dump on Memphis with draft picks attached, the league is still laughing at that trade. Still. They could have just stretched Josh Jackson. Instead, they gave up stuff to get rid of him. Like, that was just an objectively dumb trade. Now, Javon Carter's playing nice backup point guard minutes for them. I'm not sure Melton could do the same thing. And sometimes they're just not playing Javon Carter in the second rotation of the game because they'll play Tyler Johnson at point guard or Tyler Johnson and Booker. So one, like both of the things can be true. Yes, they built a better team. They got competent veterans in. Baines has been way better than I thought he would be for them. And I like Baines. Rubio's been very good, very solid. And they're going to win more games. Doesn't change the fact that they screwed up this summer. What's your, if you had to predict a ballpark win total for the Phoenix Suns this year, what would it be?
Right now?
Yeah.
I mean, this is probably kind of taking an easy way out. I mean, I'm not sure they'll keep this up for the whole season. I think that the Ayton stuff will complicate things. Again, it's a good problem to have in some ways, but it does complicate the idea of if you're a borderline playoff team, your priority still has to be developing your young guy. So for right now, I'd put him right around 40. Which I think is, you know, much higher than people would have expected. It's obviously not the pace they're at now, not even close. But there are a couple questions that come up. And when we talk about the Baines thing, it is not insignificant. It was kind of reminding me a little bit, in a much different way, last year with we all saw how well Monty Morris was playing in Denver. And you knew Isaiah Thomas was coming back. And you knew it was going to happen. And you were like, man, there's no way they can take this guy out of the lineup with the way he's rolling. I get that that's different for much different reasons. He's not a number one pick. But when you look at Baines right now with Booker, the O rating that Booker has with Baines on the court is 123. The rating with Baines off the court for Booker is 94.
Now, you could argue that that's because Ayton is going to be way better than Frank Kaminsky or whoever is getting those minutes.
Maybe, but it's going to fundamentally change the way they play when you go for one for the other. So that's a challenge. And I think the other thing, clearly, is the idea that for the Suns, Rubio is always a question, too, of like when it comes down to it, how much does that start to impact and hinder your offense when teams just – he's shot well enough so far from three to, I think, kind of offset it, but he's at a career low right now from two. I think he's shooting 36% from two. So I do think that at some point that might kind of – I won't say backfire, but I think it's going to put more pressure and allow teams to clamp down more on Booker and certain other people. So I'd put him right around 40, which I feel like I feel bad saying that because they've been so much fun to watch. Maybe there's been enough evidence to suggest that they should outkick that projection. But what do you think?
Well, first of all, with the Warriors falling out and the Pelicans off to a bad start and the Kings off to a bad start, and the Wolves coming back to earth a little bit, and the Blazers having a power forward catastrophe with Zach Collins hurt. 40 wins may get closer to the playoffs than expected in the Western Conference this season. The Suns remind me of last year's Kings.
Yeah.
In that they got off to a fast start. Everyone was like, "Wow, this is young. We all thought they'd be bad. Is this a fluke?" And I remember we did a podcast together about the Kings in December, I think in Milwaukee, November or December. And I said, I think they're actually kind of legit and they're going to win 39 games. And they won 39 games. I get that vibe about the Suns. Like, I think they're legitimately solid. I think this start has exaggerated how good they are and they'll fall back to earth a little bit, but I don't think they're going to plummet. I think they're going to stay around 500. They look like that. There seems to be one team every year that's like, oh, they're 10 to 12 games better than anyone expected for reasons that were hard to predict.
Hope for the sake of their fans and for just the team in general that you basically said, look, I'm not absolving. This does not absolve them of the stuff they got wrong last summer. And now we've seen the Kings, you know, really struggle this year. And I don't know if you attribute it to the summer.
When does the statute of limitations on blaming the India trip expire? Like game 15, game 20? Like when do they get to stop blaming them?
Never. It never comes off the books as far as the statute of limitations.
And by the way, he won't want to accept it because it's so early. But congratulations to Monty Williams. There are a few people in the league that people are rooting harder for.
That deserve it more than
Monty.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've wondered it at some point. What actually makes a better toothbrush? Industrial strength power, claims of miraculous trendy ingredients, multiple modes. If you ask your dentist, they'll tell you it's less about the brush and more about how you use the brush. That's why Quip was created by dentists and product designers to focus on what actually matters for your oral health. healthier habits. Quip's sensitive vibrations with a built-in timer guide gentle brushing for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with 30-second pulses ensuring an even clean left side, right side, everywhere. Quip automatically delivers brush heads to you every 3 months for clean new bristles right on schedule. The sleek, intuitive design is simple to use and comes with a travel cap that doubles as a mirror mount. Cool. These thoughtful features make brushing something you'll actually want to do twice a day. Good habits matter to live a healthier life, so help form fresh oral health habits with Quip. Quip starts at just $25, way less than you'd think for a high-end electric toothbrush. And you'll get your first refill free at getquip.com/low. That's my last name, L-O-W-E, the name of this podcast. It's a simple way to support our podcast and start brushing better. But all you have to do is go to getquip.com, getquip.com/low, and get your first refill pack free. Go right now to getquip.com/low. Team number two that I want to talk about, the 5-3 coming off a win over the Santa Cruz Warriors, last night, Houston Rockets. And let me get their net ratings and stuff here because I lost my page.
I think they're one point worse per 100 possessions than their opponent so far.
They are now third in offense. And it's not going to be great in defense. 28th in defense. So third and third worst. A negative one minus one rating despite a 5-3. Record. James Harden finally starting to shoot straight. Aaron Gordon not shooting all that straight. Clint Capella had maybe his first good game of the whole season last night against the Santa Cruz Warriors. Boy, oh boy, this is an interesting team, isn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, a lot of this is what I expected. Looking at how Westbrook has done so far, it's basically word for word kind of what I said in my initial thoughts on this trade, that he'll be a good fit in some ways for the roster because he's going to get to the basket more than he ever had an opportunity to when he was the guy in Oklahoma City, because there's more spacing. That was something he really never had much of in Oklahoma City. And you look at it, he's career best at the rim. He's like 72 or 73% from there. He's been brutal jump shooting, but, I mean, we're kind of used to that at this point. The thing that really shifts when you look at him and the numbers with the team and everything, their defense, when he is off the court, actually becomes probably like a top three or four defense statistically. And so, I mean, that's interesting. And when you look at different lineups with them and when you switch in certain people in their lineups, basically Gordon has been a huge albatross for them so far. He's been brutal. And I'm trying not to make too much of it from a shooting standpoint because actually the Rockets broadcast the other day brought up a really good graphic. He's been basically worse than 30% for the first 7 games of each of the last 2 seasons, and then has shot 37% for the rest of the year in each of those 2 seasons. So that's basically like hopefully what he's doing now. If you're a Rockets fan, that's hopefully what he's going through. But he hasn't finished at the rim particularly well. He had one really nice dunk the other night that kind of, really shook me up because I was like, where'd that come from? But he just hasn't looked great. I mean, he defensively hasn't been special at all. Where he obviously has moments sometimes where he'll surprise you, but Daniel House has been really good. I think that's the one good takeaway from all this. The other crazy takeaway I looked at it statistically, get this about Harden.
Get this.
He is leading the league in scoring by 5 points a game. He's doing that despite being 5 percentage points worse than league average in effective field goal rate.
I'm not looking it up. How many free throws per game is he getting?
I'm guessing it's more than 12. But it's got to be a massive number because he's shooting better now, but he's still not shooting particularly well. All I know, 46% effective field goal percentage. The league average is like 51, 52.
He's getting 16 free throw attempts per game.
Which doesn't shock me. But I mean, the guy, if I had had more time, I would have asked Sig, like the last guy to undershoot the league average in terms of effective field goal percentage by anywhere near that much and still be leading the league in scoring at all, let alone by 5 points. He's like otherworldly.
I'm starting to get a little nervous actually because Tracy McGrady and I made a bet. He thought James Harden could average 40 a game this season. Uh-huh. And I was like, that's crazy.
He's doing it on poor shooting basically.
If he does that, you can pick a restaurant. I'll take you out to dinner. He's averaging 36.5 while shooting 39% from the floor and 27% from three. I'm getting a little nervous.
I mean,
T-Mac, just keep in mind the income disparity, okay? If you're listening, just keep in mind the income disparity. That's all I'm going to say.
So my only thing, if he shoots better, if they get better on defense, the only thing I can think of, some of these games that have been tight games for them, maybe they start winning by more, and maybe you don't need Harden to log the minutes he's logging. So he still may not get to 40, but yeah, the idea of him not getting 40 because his efficiency won't be good enough, that's not going to – I mean, he's going to heat up, and he's going to get more comfortable with the situation. There are some things I look at with them that I wonder whether it will hold up. Their pace is ridiculous right now, in a way that I wonder if it's really good for them. They were obviously right at the bottom of the league in pace last year because of all the isolation stuff they do. But their defense is a thing that just kind of, you know, I didn't think they were like a true top two, top three contender in the league coming into this year. And a lot of that was because I just didn't trust the Russell Westbrook fit. And I didn't trust their defense. And that's kind of still where I'm at, even though it's basically played out the way I thought.
They're still playing fast, even when Harden plays without Westbrook.
Yeah.
They're still playing like 105 possessions per 48, which is a lot.
Sure.
Their offense has been more interesting than I thought it would be in lots of ways. Like, teams are not ignoring Westbrook to the degree that I thought they were going to, which reminds me of the famous Tom Haberstroh piece from years ago on how Dwayne Wade had much more gravity than you would think for a bad shooter because of just how explosive he is, and he's dangerous, and he's Dwayne Wade, and he can cut for a dunk in a flash. That's his nickname, when you're not looking. And I expected Russ's guy is just going to be at the foul line when James Harden is there. It's going to be a virtual double team. And that hasn't been the case. It's also been interesting to watch Harden. If you watch Harden when Russ has the ball, Harden will sometimes spend the entire possession just standing near half court. He's resting when Russ has the ball. And like, that's kind of it. We haven't had as many. There have been glimpses of it. Like, James has the ball, Russ cuts baseline for an alley-oop. James has the ball, Russ crashes in for an offensive board. A pick and roll between them here and there. Hasn't been as much of that as I would hoped, but it's still working. Offensively, it's working. Defensively, the flag is somewhere beyond red. Their bad defensive performances are so bad.
Right.
That maybe they're so bad it's almost refreshing. Like, sometimes they look like they're caught between schemes. Like, we used to switch everything, and now we switch a lot of things, but not everything. And Russ has never really played in a switch everything scheme.
Right.
And he's at the heart of a lot of their worst screw ups. So it almost gives you hope that, like, they're just getting used to some new stuff. But then some of it is like Harden is back to bad Harden defense after a couple years of like friskier by James Harden standards.
He's just not even paying attention.
Yeah,
to
Yeah,
he's the
back to, has James Harden fallen into a coma on the baseline as play
there've
continues
been plays
around?
Like that, yeah.
Oh, there's been more this season than maybe already there were all of last season.
Yeah,
and you worry that they're just going to be so bad defensively. And Capella has not been good this year, and you can tell just by the minutes distribution that D'Antoni's trust in Capella is starting to fall, and I just don't think their alternatives for their P.J. Tucker at center lineups are good enough.
They're not.
Like, Clint Capella is just better than Austin Rivers. He's better than Ben McLemore. He's better than Daniel House. He's better than those players, and I still think if they're going to hit their ceiling as a team, they need Clint Capella to be good
they
and play a lot of minutes.
They don't have another player over the height of 6'8 who's playable, really, which... Like, that's a problem. And I get that you want to play, you know, small. But the other thing is that when you look at Eric Gordon has always been a big part of their smaller lineups. And if he's playing like this, like, you can't really roll that out. I mean, you have House, but they have, let's look at it. I have a statistic on it somewhere. There are a couple that I have lined up. But first of all, so their lineups with Westbrook, Harden, Gordon, House, and Tucker. They're giving up 125 points per 100 possessions. Now, that lineup is also playing at the fastest pace in the league. So part of me, if I had to kind of say, if you locked me in a room and said I can't come out until I give you an argument that the Rockets are going to get better on defense, and please don't do that because I don't want to have to make too many of those arguments. The one stat I find really interesting with them, when they turn the ball over, they're giving up the most points per possession by far following a turnover. And so, you know, I don't know if that's totally an effort thing. I don't know if it's a fluke to start out. They're giving up more than a point and a half per time they turn the ball over, which is just kind of brutal. And so they're not turning it over nearly as much as I thought they would. I wrote a story in the summer that one of the potential pitfalls of this Russ-Harden marriage is that those guys are number one and number two in turnovers over the last 3 or 4 years by a mile. Like, I don't think there are guys within 200 or 300 turnovers of those two, where they both were at like 1,200, 1,300 turnovers over the last 3 or 4 years. But because of the pace they're playing at, I think it kind of comes back to bite them a little bit more. So if they slow the game down, maybe they turn the ball over less. Maybe that becomes less of an issue. Their defense can get set in a way. But even when they're playing and they're set on defense, even after they make a basket, they're still giving up a ton of points. So I don't know what happens with this group. I don't know that Gordon is playable at the sorts of minutes he's getting if he doesn't heat up the way
he'll
he normally
has. He'll be fine.
But their defense, I don't trust it. And we've talked about before, normally you're talking about having to be a top 10 defense to have a realistic shot of making the finals.
We're not. Daryl Morey is. He said it again this week.
But, I mean, I think he said something to the effect of, like, we have a chance to be one of the best offenses ever. And I don't see that with this group. I mean, I don't think that that would be true unless you took Russ and you made him a 35% three-point shooter, which I don't think that's going to happen.
By the way, I actually think he should take more catch-and-shoot threes because he's getting wide-open looks and turning them down. And unless his jump shot has irrevocably broken, he's had seasons where he has shot 35% on catch-and-shoot threes.
Right.
And he's never had looks like this. I kind of think he should take more.
Right.
We'll see what happens with Houston. I actually saw an interesting – I peeked at Rockets' Twitter a few days ago when they were losing by 9,000 points to the Heat in Miami. And there was an interesting debate happening about did we make a fatal mistake mortgaging the future to this degree? You know, our team is kind of looks old now, is old. One of the older teams in the league. The only first round pick, the only Houston Rockets first round pick on the team is Clint Capella. They've traded first round picks every year since 2013.
Yeah.
Was going for it to that degree when the Warriors were so clearly invincible, allegedly, was that a mistake? And I can't get with that. I'm going to die on the hill of, good for the Rockets for not giving up. Good for the Rockets for saying we have a top five player in his prime. We're freaking going for it. By the way, the Warriors didn't win the title last year. The Raptors did.
Right.
It was possible. You needed some injury luck. You needed some other breaks. Yeah, no kidding. Those happened in the NBA. I understand that take because it did feel hopeless for a while. Particularly after the first championship with Durant.
Sure.
It felt when they went 16-1 in the playoffs. It felt hopeless. I applaud. I'm not going to stop applauding the Rockets for trying.
No, I'm not either. I mean, they had 2 years where really stuff looked like it might work out. The first year where
they took them to seven.
They took them. I mean, they could have beaten them in six. So that, I mean, to put it even more bluntly, Chris Paul gets hurt. I thought they had a golden opportunity last year. Durant gets hurt, and you figure maybe they can find a way to win two more here, and they just didn't. And, you know, you can look back at those games. And I remember we had a podcast about one of those games and all the different things that the Rockets just kind of botched down the stretch. But they had their chances. And, I mean, honestly, we wrote a couple stories like this at 538 the summer before they traded for Russ. If they had kept that same roster and rolled it back out in a year like this where you have all these other teams that are new, have a really new element, I would have understood that. Now, you would be banking a lot on Chris Paul's health to do that. And it's very clear that Chris Paul has lost at least a half step. But, you know, he's one of the most cerebral guys in the game. And he's a much better defender than Russ. I would have understood that because the core of that team, if you can squeeze another year or two out of them, and Gordon's not completely ice cold, you've got Capella, you know what he is, you know what his limitations are, and you've got, again, a top five player, and at times more than that. You can win with a situation where all these other teams are kind of refurbished and brand new with the stars that they've got. And the fact that the Rockets have been closer than anybody to kind of winning the whole thing outside of the Warriors. So I would have understood rolling the same team out there. They decided not to do that. I think it's a gamble. I felt like it, you know, a gamble mostly because we know what Russ's shortcomings are. And the fact that what made the Rockets special when they had the best chance of doing this was their defense and Harden. And now it's mostly Harden and You hope that Russ is enough of a superstar to carry you over the
line. That year they won 67 games, 2017-18. They were hungry. They were hungrier than the Warriors. They wanted it so bad. And they felt, you could feel it just talking to them. Like, they felt 20 games in, okay, we got a shot. Mm-hmm. Like, we're better than, we're really good. We got a shot. Mm-hmm. Let's go for it. And maybe that team just had a shelf life. I mean, look, you said the trade for Russ was a gamble. It's not a gamble if the Chris James relationship has deteriorated.
That's true, too.
To the point where it became a necessity for whatever reason.
Sure.
And I think something happened. Whatever it was, remember there was reports he demanded a trade, then he didn't demand a trade, then they weren't going to trade him, then they traded him, then there's always reports of tension during game six against the Warriors. Something happened. By the way, two fun stats, and then we'll move off the Rockets.
Okay.
I think you and I would probably be in agreement that their best lineup is Westbrook, Harden, Gordon, Tucker, Capella. That's like their closing five, their best five.
Yes. I want to see how much longer Daniel House keeps this up, though.
Okay, fair enough.
Other than that,
going into
one of
the season,
sure.
You look at that, that's your lineup.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That lineup's played 16 minutes this year.
Wow.
Minus 46.
Wow. But that's the problem.
They're 1 of 13 from deep. Their net rating is like, it's like 33 points per 100 possessions and like 190 points a lot. It's just funny. It's just a funny
small sample size. Gordon has to,
you know how hard it is to be minus 46? They were almost minus 46 in 16 minutes against Miami as a team.
But when you have Gordon and Harden shooting as poorly as they started, I mean, and those guys are taking a vast majority. Well, I guess Westbrook's out there too, but like a big chunk of your shots. It actually doesn't shock me that stuff could get that bad, but that's pretty bad.
Second stat that I thought was amazing that I get into more on another podcast that shall not be named quite yet, so I don't want to talk more about it. James Harden in the 2018 playoffs, the year they took the Warriors to seven. How many minutes do you think how many minutes do you think James Harden played in those playoffs in which the score was within 3 points in the last 3 minutes of the game? Like clutch. How many clutch minutes within 3 points?
Including the Warriors series?
The whole playoffs. The whole playoffs. How many such minutes do you think James Harden played?
Man, this is one of those where I'm going to guess, and I don't know if it's going to be close or way off. How many minutes? Somewhere in the 40s?
Six.
Really?
Six. And I looked this up for this podcast.
I must not remember that playoff.
Because every game was a blowout. They had blowouts just every game. And my point in saying that is James Harden has played 81 minutes, such minutes, in his entire career. My point is only this. James Harden's signature playoff moment is what? Probably the shot for the Thunder that iced the Spurs series in 2012. I don't know that he has a signature positive playoff moment.
I thought you were about to say signature, period, because I'm like, it's a Spurs game, but it's not that
one. He's got some signature negative playoff moments.
That Spurs series.
I don't know that he has a moment in his career since then.
That's incredible. He played six.
He was 0 for 3. He took 3 shots in the last 3 minutes of close games that entire playoffs. Which is to say, James Harden's 30. Like, this is the time where it's like, you know, careers are made, legacies are made. It's a big, big year for James Harden.
Six clutch minutes.
Let's move off the Rockets. Those are my Rockets stats. I'll let you pick the next team we talk about. Do you want to do Dallas or San Antonio?
Let's do San Antonio. I kind of want to save Dallas for last because I find Dallas fascinating. So
the San Antonio Spurs are 4-3.
Okay.
And they are, I keep losing my page, they are 14th in offense and 14th in defense. How wonderful. And they are doing their thing where they are the team on offense that they try to make every other team on defense. So they take a million mid-range shots and no threes and no shots at the rim, whereas their entire defense is to make teams take a million mid-range shots and no threes and no shots at the rim. And they're very, very good at it. No team is allowing fewer threes than the Spurs. It's a really unbelievable dissonance to design your defense a certain way and then play offense that exact way.
So it'll be really interesting when they get I won't say new regime because I feel like you can't say anything as a new regime until Pop isn't there anymore. But the guys on that team, I just think really love that shot. You've got Aldridge. You've got DeRozan. I mean, Rudy Gay was once a person who lived from that area of the court, which is what I think makes DeJounte Murray so interesting because he is back. He's healthy. And he just, first of all, his usage surprises me a little bit. He's been shooting the ball quite a bit. He's been quite aggressive.
Scored 16 straight against the Lakers in the fourth quarter.
The guy,
and looked like a star.
That guy's contract is going to be such a bargain if he stays healthy for the next 4 years, which I certainly hope he does. I mean, we already knew he was special defensively as a youngster. Offensively, he's been fun. I mean, you still see plays here and there where he kind of gets caught in between, sometimes going to the basket and maybe doesn't have a play all the way figured out as far as what he wants to do with the ball. But one of the things I find interesting about him, kind of in Tony Parker-esque sort of fashion, is that he speeds them up quite a bit. The Spurs have always been, you know, for like the last 10 years at least, kind of a slower team. You know, people always made that argument, unless you were a diehard or you were a Spurs fan, you weren't going to enjoy watching the Spurs play because of the style that they play, and, you know, kind of an old-fashioned style. They are, for the first time that I could even find on the NBA.com stats page, in the top half of the league in transition frequency. Really interesting, and sort of for the first time in years they are, and it's basically because of Murray. I think a third of his offense so far is coming from transition. So he's pushing the ball a lot. He's finding a lot of easy baskets that way. The other interesting thing about the Spurs that I normally don't think about, because of some of the stuff we've talked about, how much they live from the mid-range area where you don't get free throws from, they're a top five free throw team so far, which that's the first time
that's not
happened.
Spursy. That's not a Spursy.
It's not Spursy at all, and it's the first time since 2010-11 that they've ranked in the top half of the league, let alone top five. So they're a little different this year. I mean, I feel like they're too vested in the guys that make their offense what it is, with, again, DeRozan, Aldridge, to probably stay that way. That's probably a stat that looks that way now that I don't expect to stay that way. But they're interesting. And, you know, I don't know. I'm of the opinion that as long as Murray is getting to take the risks that he's taking offensively, I'm fine with whatever happens with him. I could see them making the playoffs. At this point, it's the Spurs. You always have to expect them to make the playoffs whether you want to or not, particularly with what you've said about the other teams in the West kind of being injured, you know, looking like they're already falling off a little bit. You know, the Spurs are the Spurs. I kind of find them the least interesting of these teams that we've talked about in this Texas group with the Suns.
I find them a little more interesting than I thought.
Okay.
An intriguing thing, Chris Herring. Do you want to hear an intriguing thing?
Sure.
DeMar DeRozan, Derek White, and DeJounte Murray have played 0 minutes together this season. I think they played one possession.
Wow.
So that's DeRozan, White, Murray. You get why, right? Three blah shooters, although Derek White is sneakily shooting pretty well from three, over 40%, I think.
I wouldn't trust him defensively, though.
Another trio. I would trust him. Any unit with Derek White and DeJounte Murray on the floor, I'm going to trust defensively, even if DeMar DeRozan's also part of it.
Okay.
On the flip side, Derek White, DeJounte Murray, Bryn Forbes.
That's actually who I was thinking. I'm sorry. You said DeJounte, and I was like, wait a minute. DeJounte's always good.
DeJounte,
that trio, I would trust.
DeJounte, Forbes, and White. Again, I will trust them defensively.
Okay.
Has also played 0 minutes together.
Interesting.
And why that's interesting to me is the Spurs have this interesting young core of perimeter players. And we haven't mentioned Lonnie Walker, the Johnson kid.
He hasn't played a whole lot yet, right?
No.
Barely.
And they have two veteran fulcrums, one of whom, DeMar DeRozan, has a player option for next season. They've talked about an extension with him. That's been reported. They have not signed one. And the other has a $24 million partially guaranteed contract, and that's LaMarcus Aldridge.
Right.
The Spurs are almost a sleeping giant in this sense. They have all their picks. They have a lot of young players. And they have some major, major decisions to make about what kind of team they want to be
right
going forward. John Hollinger pitched the idea that they're in position to make a win-now trade. I actually think it should be the opposite. I don't think DeRozan plus Aldridge is good enough to trade out of the bucket of interesting young players to upgrade the present-day core. I think the more interesting question is, If you had to pick DeRozan or Aldridge to be on the team next year,
which one would you pick? Right.
And despite the fact that he's 4 years older, I would want Aldridge because I just don't have a lot of big men that I trust. And I have all these guards. And you do need an offensive fulcrum. Like, I'm not sure you vaporize both of them from the team. I don't know what their offensive identity yet. Maybe it is. Maybe they find one. Pop is a genius, etc. I like having one around, as unsexy as they are. I'm not sure that DeRozan is helping their team hardly at all if Aldridge is there. And you have all of these other perimeter alternatives. Like, to me, it's a shame that White, Murray, Forbes has not played a second yet. Because I'd like to see – I want more White, Murray minutes, period. I want those two on the floor more. And I can't have that with DeRozan because he's not shooting threes anymore. But he stinks defensively. He takes a million shots. Now, he's a good player. He's a floor.
I don't know what prompted me to look at it. I think he's taken a three or two this year.
No, he went to the Spurs and stopped.
And it's kind of crazy because you remember three years ago, we were all talking excitedly about the fact that he was taking more than he'd ever taken before.
Yeah, it turns out the Raptors forced him to.
And so he goes to the Spurs, and it's an offense that already, with Aldridge, already plays into the idea that, and Pop came out and said it to try to, you know, because of what he had dealt with Aldridge. We're not trying to change you here. You know, the Spurs really didn't have stars on the team, you know, and DeMar DeRozan comes over as an all-star. And so, look, we're not trying to change you. We want to ease you into this. Do what makes you comfortable. And immediately, I mean, he's literally at career low levels for threes he's taken, which in a year where, like, everybody's taking them. Like,
meanwhile, even LaMarcus has taken threes this year.
I know. And I mean, the thing is, I don't know. I just feel like the team, so many of their guys, it's their bread and butter to shoot from there.
My general point is DeMar's a good player. He's a floor raiser. He's a classic NBA floor raiser. If you have him on your team, it's very hard to be bad.
Right.
He's not a ceiling raiser. And given their other perimeter talent, even though there are nights where he scores 25 points and he looks good, and it's like, wow, I can't imagine what the Spurs would be like if this guy were not soaking up these 19 shots and 6 free throws and 4 assists. His assists are a little bit down this year after last year.
Sure.
I actually can imagine these Spurs without DeMar DeRozan, and I'd like to see them without DeMar DeRozan.
This is going to be mean. He's kind of like a wisdom tooth. Where you worry a little bit.
Now
about
that's just
idea.
That's just mean. That's too mean.
It's mean, but honestly, what I mean by that is that it might be hindering the progress of the young guys, and you don't know until he's out of the way. Now, again, if you decide that their offense would change fundamentally if you moved on from Aldridge and left DeRozan there. But the truth is, like, you kind of saw some really good attributes from DeRozan last year when you didn't have Murray and the idea that he can move the ball. I mean, he out of the gate was having like career best assist numbers because they didn't really have other guys. Obviously, Forbes emerged and had a really good season. But you don't know what all you can do with those young guys. You don't know how they look together, which is basically what you're saying you're curious about. And so in a way, until he's out of the way or until he takes a much reduced role, or until he comes off the bench, which Rudy Gay has basically done that. And frankly, what I guess I would like to see in the next couple of years, if we're being honest, is essentially DeRozan taking on a Rudy Gay sort of role where I don't even know if Rudy's
to your point,
usage has come down that much, but
Rudy's been great for them.
But he's been really good, and I feel like his game changed a lot as far as what he was trying to do. I want to say some of that came with shooting more threes, too, as opposed
more
to
threes,
being mid-range.
Playing power forward almost exclusively.
So some of that is what I guess. I mean, and I guess he's obviously bigger than DeMar as well. But I that's kind of the role that at some point you'd like, the same way that we talked about how Vince has kind of aged so gracefully in an NBA career. Rudy has done that on a smaller scale, and I guess that's kind of what I'd love to see for DeRozan at some point. Maybe he can do that with San Antonio. But I don't imagine that that's how he views himself right now. And it's probably early for him to view himself that way right now.
So it sounds a little strange, given that, again, LaMarcus is 4 years older and not off to a very good start. He's off to just an start. I would run away from a DeMar DeRozan extension if I were the Spurs, unless it were a pay cut so dramatic that he becomes a huge trade asset. And by the way, if you put DeMar DeRozan on the trade market right now, whether on an expiring deal or a long-term deal, I'm not sure what the level of interest is going to be.
Huh.
And if you put him in unrestricted free agency this summer, Why is a rebuilding team like Atlanta or Charlotte or Cleveland going to sign DeMar DeRozan? I just don't see what the point is.
Unless you're just
desperate to get the eighth seed.
I don't remember off the top of my head who's got space. The team that immediately
those teams
the team that immediately
don't say
came
the Knicks.
Mind,
don't say
no,
it.
No, I don't think they would do it. They've got so many guys they need to figure out for themselves who are guys that need the ball in their hands. The team that came to mind, and I don't even think that they're going to have space because they seem like they're capped out forever, is Detroit, because they're always looking at a guy that can kind of put them over the top for that year. And DeRozan might do that.
That's a trade team. That's the kind of team it would take, I think, to trade.
So that would make sense to me. But yeah, you're right. I don't think he's a natural fit for most teams.
I'd rather give LaMarcus, like, see if I can tack on a year to LaMarcus's deal.
To kind of put the decision further out.
Then extend DeRozan. Okay. Sure. That's it for the Spurs. I think the Spurs are solid. I picked them to make the playoffs.
You gave me a more interesting angle than I thought there was with them, as far as, like, they're kind of the same way a lot of us before the Kyle extension talked about the Raptors, with regards to the idea that, like, they're interesting, even if you don't think they're going to be a contender, which they're not, they're going to be interesting because of X, Y, and Z, because of the trade market possibly.
Sometimes for inspiration, you just have to look up. For more than 60 years, the Goodyear blimp has fueled greatness on the gridiron by providing aerial coverage of some of the most legendary moments in college football history. When the Goodyear blimp rises above a stadium, it inspires players to reach higher and rise to the challenge of the game's biggest moments. Now it's your turn to go further with Goodyear. Discover tires made to rise above the rest. Learn more at Goodyear.com. Goodyear, more driven. Let's talk about what we both agree is the most interesting of these three teams, and that's the Dallas Mavericks, who are 5-2 after a unconvincing win over the Orlando Magic last night, with the Magic actually scored some points last night. Dallas is number 2 in offense, a hair behind the Milwaukee Bucks, and number, I think, 21 in defense. Or they're up to 18 last night after playing the Orlando Magic, who can't score any points. 5-2, Porzingis, Doncic, good bench, interesting team. I think a little better than people anticipated. Take it anywhere you want. What's interesting about the Mavs?
What's interesting to me is that I think you could kind of splice that up any way you want to. You could either be, I mean, you're probably excited about the 5-2 record. You're excited about how deep this team is, because they had 9 guys in double figures against Denver the other night, which, like, I had to do like a double take at the box score. But what's interesting about it to me is, like, are they 5-2 and they have a ton of upside because Doncic and Porzingis haven't played well together and their net rating as a duo is bad? So how do you view that sort of thing? Because that's my question, is it a sign that they're not going to gel, which we're only 2 weeks in, so it's obviously too early to say that. But if they are going to get really – if they're going to really get a lot better with those guys once they get more comfortable with each other – what's the ceiling for this team? And I think that there is a cap on the ceiling, because I think that there are a couple things they're missing when I look at them, but they played well. They obviously can score. They obviously have a lot of depth to this team. But I just think that it's interesting that they're having this much success without Porzingis and Luka having gelled at all.
Yeah, they're minus 4.6 per 100 possessions with the two cornerstones on the floor together. They're winning games when Doncic plays without Porzingis. They're plus a gazillion.
It's massive.
And
yeah,
when both of them are on the bench, they're plus, I'll look it up in a second, they're plus a shocking amount with both of those guys on the bench, which is indicative of how effective their reserves have been. And they've changed the starting lineup like 4 or 5 times already.
They have, yeah.
I like their mix. So let's put, why have they not played well together? What have you seen? Why is it not meshing between the two of them?
So some of this is kind of goes back to when I covered KP. He, from his rookie year, I felt like, and then after that, I remember I thought the Knicks made a mistake. They brought in Derrick Rose that second year for Porzingis and had him and Carmelo and kind of raised the question immediately of whether Porzingis was going to become a third option. I think he can get lost really, really easily. He's not overwhelmingly assertive about getting the ball. So a good example, that Lakers game the other night, which was so much fun to watch, where Luka and LeBron both go for triple doubles, and Porzingis just went, he literally could have put him on a milk carton in the second half. He was just lost, wasn't doing anything. And I feel like when he's not involved, you go a few possessions in a row without having him touch the ball, and like you forget he's there. And I think that's just kind of who he is. And I think there are certain things about the way their offense is structured that kind of make it easier for him to get lost. And I think part of it was also something that I realized when I was covering the Knicks, not with Porzingis specifically, but when the Knicks had Melo and Amari and Tyson Chandler, they wanted to run screen and roll all the time with Raymond Felton. Chandler was the guy that ran the pick and roll. And so because of that, you almost never saw Melo and Amari run the pick and roll together. And obviously Amari was a killer in the pick and roll for years. And so it just kind of left Amari standing out there by himself. That's kind of what happens with Porzingis sometimes, I think, when Dwight Powell is on the floor.
And Kleba, both of them.
Yeah, because you need to involve them. You want to use your vertical spacing. And KP is more of a pick and pop player, really rarely rolls to the basket. And so it kind of leaves him out there. And he doesn't have an immediate way to get involved. And so I think there's going to be some, I think Carlisle's got a couple challenges. One is, how do you involve a guy that is a cornerstone for you because of what you just invested to get him? And that goes from a contract standpoint, but also the trade. Two is, how do you make use of this rotation? Because even the game against Orlando, I think Seth Curry played 6 minutes. I think Jalen Brunson played 6 minutes.
JJ Barea's first game back.
Right.
And they rode JJ. JJ Barea came on the floor, and God bless him, made shots, banked in a three. Yeah. Crowd was going crazy. All of a sudden, Luka was standing in the corner, and it was the JJ Barea show. Yeah. It was pretty funny.
So that's the thing. And again, it speaks to, it's a blessing to have that problem. But it is a problem, because I do think that there are going to be certain nights where, you have so many options, but they don't have all the options in the right places. So I think the figuring out the center rotation, I think, is, Powell has looked horrible defensively at times this year, in my opinion. So I think that that's a challenge. The other thing I look at when I see this team, is they look like they need like one more vet. A lot of these guys are young, and they're not good defensively. They're not, at least not yet. And when I think about the teams, we haven't heard his name a whole lot lately, and when we do, it's always in conjunction with the Lakers. I feel like Iguodala would fit well with this team. And maybe that's just a random thought. I don't know why I think that. I doubt he would want to play there. It's not a contender, so to speak.
He would fit very well.
But I would really like him on this team. And I just kind of see some rotation challenges with it. It's a really talented team. But I just think that Porzingis, to circle all the way back to a question you asked 7 minutes ago probably, I think Porzingis can get lost, and I don't think Luka is looking for him necessarily. I think Luka is kind of an equal opportunity distributor, essentially. And I think that Porzingis can get lost in an offense like that where, frankly, he's never had to play with someone else when he was on the same level as them. Unless you're arguing that Carmelo and him were on the same level when Porzingis first got in the league. But even when that was the case, he wasn't assertive. The veterans didn't look for him or pass him the ball in the fourth quarter, and I've seen that happen here as well.
They're plus 25 in 46 minutes with both of them off the floor. And, yeah, you hit it on the head. Porzingis has mostly been a floor spacer for Doncic, Powell, Doncic, Kleba, pick and rolls. Now, that's, first of all, a valuable role.
Sure.
KP's a good shooter. He can shoot over anybody. And he's not just – obviously, he does more. They run – Luka and KP run, like, 15 pick and rolls per 100 possessions or something like that. And that play should be really effective because – both of them are dangerous shooting. Both of them are dangerous going to the basket. Both of them should be able to punish switches. And I think that's the hit or miss ingredient of Porzingis' game, is you put a littler guy on him and he's settling for a lot of fadeaways. And they're just not great shots. What they look real pretty when they go in, but he's not Dirk. You gotta be Dirk to make that a high points per possession shot. Yep. And he's not Dirk, and he's gotta get better at getting to the line and doing something other than turning and shooting an 18-foot fadeaway jumper over a 6'4 guy.
He's never been great at that.
He's not.
I wrote a story the year before last. He got his mid-range jumpers, and a lot of them were fadeaways, blocked at a higher rate than anybody in the league when I wrote the story. And it's crazy to think that he's the tallest guy in the league along with Boban, but he was getting, and I kind of looked at it and got some data on his shot release and where it is. And it's one of the lower shot releases in the league for volume shooters. So for whatever reason, he gets blocked a lot, but he's not getting that shot over people nearly as easily as it looks. And I do think it's one of those things where when he makes it, it looks so pretty that people kind of overlook the fact that it's not as effective as you would think it would be for someone his size.
I do think as he gets healthier, they will explore more minutes with him as a center.
Okay.
And maybe he rolls more than in that circumstance when there's nobody that he's rolling into. Or maybe even like Kleba can shoot a little bit. Powell can shoot a little bit. Maybe you can use him as a roller with those. You know, look, their third best player isn't good enough for them to be a contender, but they have a lot of fifth best players on their team.
They do.
They have a lot of good players on the team. I like they are currently starting a lineup that's so big and rangy that Doncic is almost kind of the two. It's like a littler guy.
That's
sometimes
true.
Seth Curry, sometimes DeLon Wright, who's not playing as much as I thought. Doncic, Finney Smith, who looks very frisky this year. He looks very aggressive. Like, what got into Dorian Finney Smith? I like this guy. He's driving closeouts. He's going at people on defense
it's
even more.
And
then the two big guys. And Doncic has just been absolutely incredible.
Yeah, he has.
The pass, we're talking about the rim runners, Powell and Kleba. I think Doncic already is the best lob passer in the whole league. His lobs are the touch, the accuracy, and the timing. Like, he's throwing them when from angles you don't expect. At times you don't expect, like, you almost think it's too late, but really he has such a good sense of timing that it's perfect, but it feels too late to the defense, or it's too early, or he's, like, leaning backward but still throws a lob. His timing and touch on lobs is... I think he's the best lob passer in the whole league. He has four every night where I'm like, oh, my God, yeah. That was incredible.
And the thing is, there were elements of that you could see last year. And so, I mean, it's funny. And I think Dallas was kind of a sexy pick for a lot of people this year because you figured Luka plus Porzingis equals wins. And it's interesting to think that part of it hasn't worked out just yet as far as that duo. But the fact that they're winning at this clip, like I said, I think you could make a really optimistic argument that's rooted in fact pretty easily with this team, because the fact that they've done it without them looking like they have a true synergy yet, you hope it bodes well. I mean, I guess the downside is that they never get on the same page. I looked at the numbers for it. I think Porzingis is shooting something like 28 or 30% off passes from Luka so far.
Wow.
And 1 of 8 from three. So, I mean, it will get better from here. I can't imagine it getting worse. I can't imagine it staying the same. And a lot of it, too, you have to figure Porzingis, to his credit, has said, I'm pretty frustrated with how I'm playing because I don't feel like I'm myself yet.
And by the way, he hadn't played in 19 months.
Exactly. And so we'll see how that pans out.
And
I feel like that's part of this.
I wonder at some point if they'll start load managing him a little bit and what that will do to their team. But I think they're a solid team. I picked them to make the playoffs. I think they're going to stay in the race and make the playoffs.
I think they'll make it. I don't know what they'll be seed-wise. I just don't. And even if they get in as like a high seed, I don't know that I trust their defense yet. Maybe it'll get better.
No, and Porzingis has been. And on the glass, Orlando exploited it last night. Orlando, a team that does an offensive rebound, clearly said, let's attack these guys because we don't think they can keep us off the glass. And they couldn't. And they're now a bottom five or six defensive rebounding team. Porzingis has never been a very good rebounder. And he's not one of those guys who is boxing guys out.
No.
And that's why he's not getting rebounds like the Lopez twins, who never get any rebounds, but they're always boxing seven guys out at the same time. So they have some weak spots. Defensively, I think upside this year is probably average. But going forward, Doncic is now ascended. This version of Doncic is an MVP candidate.
Yeah.
Last year's version was like a really, really good rookie and borderline all-star.
Right.
If this is what he is now and he has another level to get to after this,
scary.
Then they have an MVP candidate every year on their team. And if Porzingis is just a borderline all-star, that's still really good.
Yeah.
But yeah, they haven't ironed out the partnership, but that makes it more interesting. It'd kind of be boring if they were like meshing right away and all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. You got to go. Chris Herring, you can read his stuff at 538. He wrote about Draymond Green. We didn't even talk about Draymond Green. We've written enough of him, talked enough about the Warriors.
I'm hoping to not write about the Warriors again this year.
And Phoenix time. Last year, all of his stuff is outstanding. Chris, I always love when you come on. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate you.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.